Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. And joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's the senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sean.
And expected to join us a little later on the phone will be Josh Balling, the assistant editor at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. And Tim Wood will join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and Islands. We'll start with an island, Martha's Vineyard. What's happening over there with the tribe, which got involved in the casino debate in a big way this week?
Yeah, it's been a busy week in the casino industry here in Massachusetts, and nothing bigger than the announcement on Tuesday by the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah, announcing that they had gotten a federal opinion that their land over on Martha's Vineyard is eligible for gaming. This is huge because for years, there's been a back and forth between the state and the tribe, saying that, the tribe saying, we have these federal rights, and the state saying, no, you waived those rights when you made a land settlement with us back in 1987 is when it was codified by the Congress. And so the tribe has insisted they have these rights. They've tried to get the governor to negotiate a compact with them. He's refused to do that. Instead, he turned his attention to the Mashpee Wampanoag, as we know, and he has made a deal with them. In the meantime, the Aquinnah have been trying desperately to get someone to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have these rights.
Right.
And so now the National Indian Gaming Commission has come out with this ruling. And basically what they're saying is the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which allows gaming on reservation land, trumps any land settlement for any tribe. So that's the key distinction here.
Is that because of concerns that some land settlement back, you know, 30, 40, 50, a decade, you know, a century ago, states could try to look at that and say, no, you don't have these rights? Is that why it trumps it?
Yeah, ultimately, that's just right. And a tribe, an Indian tribe that's federally recognized, is a sovereign nation.
Mm.
And that type of an agreement would be taking away rights of a sovereign. And so that's the argument. And what the tribe has always said, and it's a pretty good argument, is, look, we didn't know we had this right when we made the settlement with the state. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act went into effect in 1988. That's the year after the settlement was signed off on by Congress. And of course, the settlement was in the works for years. The irony in all this is that the state is working with a tribe that fought them for years. You know, at the same time, the Aquinnah tribe was working out a settlement agreement with the state and the town of Aquinnah, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe were suing the state in federal court. Now, they lost and ultimately had to go through the process to get federally recognized, which happened in 2007. But the state is working with that tribe.
Right.
That fought with them for years.
So what is the tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah saying they're actually allowed to do now with this letter from the feds?
So what happens with Indian gaming law is if you can prove you have tribal lands, which is which are lands in trust with the federal government, they have more than 400 acres over on the island, that you're allowed to open a Class II casino without any other permissions except from the federal government. They don't have to go to the state. They don't have to share any revenue with the state. Class two, just to make the distinction for people, a Class three casino is what a Las Vegas casino is like. You have blackjack, you have roulette, you have poker, you have slot machines. In a Class two facility, you can have high stakes bingo, but there are also this invention that was created in the 90s, maybe early 2000s. Called bingo slots. And those look and act like any other type of slot machine. The players really don't know any difference. And so that's a moneymaker. The Seminole tribe of in Florida,
yeah.
They made billions before the state finally decided to negotiate with them and say, we need to get a piece of this. They had all they had was these bingo slot machines in their Hard Rock hotels.
So conceivably, the tribe on the vineyard could put in an order for these slot machines, have them delivered, and open up at any time, potentially running into conflict with the state.
That's right. And it's going to be interesting to see how they go about this. They haven't really said yet exactly what they're going to do. They say they're going to use their community center over there. I think at the moment they're using that as leverage with the governor to say, look, we want a casino on the mainland, and we want you to negotiate with us. But if you don't, we're going to put these slot machines into the community center that they have on their reservation land.
Has the Aquinnah spoken to other communities in the state, Fall River, New Bedford, any place like that,
yes,
about their interest?
You might recall a year and a half ago, they actually had a vote in Freetown and Lakeville. Freetown and Lakeville. They had land there right on the line. Both towns said no to them. But in both instances, the Aquinnah said it was the governor and his unwillingness to negotiate with them that made those votes go down. But they also have some friends in Fall River with land, and I don't know that they own any land at the moment in southeastern Mass, mm-hmm, but there are certainly landowners out there who are willing to sell to them.
Okay, someone just handed me a report from the Associated Press that says Governor Deval Patrick says he plans to meet with the leaders of the Wampanoag of Aquinnah, but does not anticipate a change in the state's position that the Martha's Vineyard-based tribe is ineligible for casino gambling. So the governor at least will meet with them and start a conversation.
It's an interesting development, and I did get an email from the chairwoman, Cheryl Andrews-Maltese, last night, who said she had a friendly conversation with Governor Patrick yesterday. I also heard him on WGBH yesterday.
Yep.
He has asked the governor's show on that. And he said he's standing behind his position at this point, but he does have his legal team looking at this new federal decision.
The tribe is just days away from an election over on the island. How does that play into all of this?
Well, that could be significant because Andrews-Maltese is up for re-election in that. And there is her opponent is not a fan of the casino project. So
right. You spoke with him, I believe, in the paper.
Right,
yesterday.
Right. One of our reporters went over to the island and tried to, you know, sort of get the temperature over there of how people were feeling about all of this. And there was mixed reaction, even among tribe members over there, as to whether this is the way to go.
Right. So it leads me back to a statement that you said earlier, that perhaps this is really a way to get the governor to the table. Perhaps there really isn't, and I'm saying this, not you, but perhaps there really isn't the push over there to do it on Martha's Vineyard, but rather get permission to come over to the mainland. You think that might be what's happening here?
I think leverage is certainly in play here. But there are examples of tribes across the country that have done this, and what they've forced the state governments to do is they open up a casino on their tribal land, they put in the slot machines, they force the state to come in and shut them down, and then it goes to court. Rather than the other way around, the tribe going to court up front trying to get it all settled.
And of course, the leadership of the tribe at Aquinnah was saying back, 2010, look, if you legalize, we're moving forward. If you legalize casino gambling in the state, we're moving forward. And then the state opened up this box when it legalized.
Yeah, and I'm not sure you're aware of this, but previous administrations, I think it's the Weld administration and then Cellucci after that, they actually made deals with this tribe.
Mm-hmm.
They had compacts with this tribe that said, if the state ever legalizes gambling, we're going to allow this tribe to build. One of them was in Fall River. So
let's move on to the next story about Trudy Hall, a woman from Nantucket. And let's bring Josh Balling in on the conversation. Josh is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, you there?
I'm here.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Why don't I ask George to kind of lay out the recent developments, and then, Josh, I'd like to get your perspective and what people are saying on the island and just how this has kind of played out on the island since this awful murder, since this woman went missing.
Yeah, 3 years. 3 years since she went missing, and a couple of years since her body was found in the woods in Falmouth. This news came out this week of an indictment, and it's Quizzell Wilson. He's 35, apparently a boyfriend of hers at the time, and he was a married man. The district attorney tells us that the baby that she was carrying, she was pregnant, is his baby. Some closure for the family, the mother. We've talked to her many times over the years. Just, you know, when Trudy was missing, she was just distraught, of course. And then with no one being brought to justice for this, and now finally someone at least being charged. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see if he's convicted. Certainly his attorney is saying that he didn't do it. But it's an interesting case, and one of the interesting things that the DA said this week, and he doesn't say a lot usually about cases, but one of the things he said is, he said when her body was found that she was going to speak to us, and he said in a sense, when they did find her body, that's exactly what happened, and that led investigators to Mr. Wilson.
Josh, tell us about Trudy. She was 24, she was pregnant. Who was she over on the island, and what happened?
Trudy Hall was a Nantucket High School graduate. She was a soccer player, an athlete, honor student here at Nantucket. She went on to college after she graduated. She returned to the island, and then things apparently got a little more complicated. Sources and friends told us and told the Cape Cod Times that she apparently was involved in some kind of immigration scam where she would marry more than one man at the same time in exchange for payments, cash payments, sometimes as much as $20,000 in exchange for granting citizenship. And it unveiled or revealed, I guess, some loopholes in the state system where apparently you can be married to more than one person at the same time, and there's no cross-referencing as long as you do it in different communities or different counties. And she went missing in 2010. She took a trip from Nantucket to the mainland. Her mother reported her missing the next day, and then, you know, it took quite a while. Her remains weren't discovered until last April, about almost a year and a half ago now. Mr. Wilson was a person of interest. The DA's office has confirmed for quite some time. He was questioned. His house was searched. A number of items, including a car and a motorcycle and some other things, were seized and eventually returned. But I think the feeling on Nantucket now and the feeling with the family is this has been a long time coming, and everybody does understand that the wheels of justice often turn slowly. But there's been a lot of questions as to why it took this long. These things sometimes do take time. And I think there is a feeling of closure to some degree, but this is only the beginning of a process that's probably going to take quite some time longer.
Josh, has there been any further discussion about this immigration scam that law enforcement sources had spoken to the media about, a year or so ago?
Not too much, no. We've talked with the Nantucket police out here, and they confirmed that they run across this type of thing from time to time. They investigate quite often. There's not too many places they can take it. Immigration on the Cape and Islands is a hot-button issue, has been for years, with undocumented workers. There's a fairly sizable ethnic population on the island and on the Cape, and there is obviously some undocumented people here. There's been a number of federal stings on the island over the years, particularly a large one a few years ago, where a number of people were deported, taken off the island, all criminals, actually, with criminal records. The police chief on Nantucket said at the time, and I said before, that the ethnic workers and ethnic residents of the island, regardless of their immigration status, are not being targeted simply for their immigration status, but that particular raid was to rid the island of some people who were preying on their own people as well as the community.
This woman was pregnant at the time. George, what's being discussed about that? He's not at present time being charged with the death of this unborn child.
Yeah, that question was certainly posed to Michael O'Keefe, the district attorney, this week, and he said that it had been considered, but he's not hopeful. And he said it had to do with the viability of the fetus. He didn't go into a lot of details on that. And he didn't speak about a motive, and that wasn't discussed in the courtroom either, although a lot of people are looking at this, and, they see that she was pregnant, and now we know that at least according to the district attorney, that it was Mr. Wilson's baby. So, you know, whether that had any role in this or not, but the district attorney said he's not hopeful to bring charges with regard to the baby.
Josh Balling, anything else about this story that we should know?
Only maybe perhaps that you know, Mr. Wilson also does have a connection to the island. He was a former U.S. Marine from Mississippi who spent some time on the island, actually has a prior criminal record from his days here. He was charged with some theft from the island's Nantucket Regional Transit Authority, the seasonal shuttle bus system. When he was arrested, police also discovered a loaded handgun inside his vehicle. He was ultimately convicted and then a plea agreement given a 2-year suspended jail sentence in order to pay back about $8,500. So he was living on the Cape, and then he was arrested in Boston, but he also had some Nantucket connections.
And right now he's being held without bail?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Josh Balling, he is the assistant editor at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you so much for joining us, Josh.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the death of one of Cape Cod's most notorious criminals.
I'm Marianne Bartlett. This is probably 1963, when I was about to turn 2, and my aunt had visited, and my parents brought her to the boat so she could get back onto the Nopska. And they left me in the back of the car snoozing away and helped her onto the Nopska till they yelled, "Last call, get off the boat." And my mother looked up and saw the dock going by and said, "I think the boat is moving." And my father said, "Impossible." And I was asleep in the car with no one with me. The boat kept going, and my mother screamed from the railing, "My baby's in the car! Save my baby!" And my father describes the story as, he convinced the captain, is how he puts it, to turn around.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
In honor of the space program, our child-hating teacher, Miss Ross, divides the class into 3 groups based on ability: stars, rockets, and moons. Even though I'm a moon, I quickly deduce which is the dumb group.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the public radio exchange, PRX.org.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Tuesday afternoon at 2.
Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran. I'm a senior reporter and senior editor here at WCAI. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan, a senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. George, you've been covering Melvin Rainey and everything surrounding his cases for a few years now. And then this week we hear Melvin Rainey, also known as the Fox, has died. Tell us about Melvin Rainey. I was just saying to you during the break, I've been reading these stories. There is so much to this over such a period of time, and the intrigue is almost unbelievable. It's really hard to kind of wrap your head around just who this man was and just what happened here in Falmouth in particular when he was active in the community.
Yeah, you talk about this outside of Falmouth and people say, "Really? This happened in Falmouth?" Because you think of Falmouth as this lovely coastal town, which it is. It certainly is. But Melvin Rainey started his reign of terror here in Falmouth back in the late 1960s. He actually started out, he was an arsonist, and he was convicted of arson in the late 60s. He set quite a few fires, a couple of them here in Woods Hole. And those fires terrified people. They came at weird times. He was known as the firebug at the time. And he would actually show up at some of these fires. And he would say, "Hey," to the police, "have you caught the firebug yet?" And you hear that about arsonists all the time. He went to jail for a few years. When he came back in the early 70s, he came back, many people say, a changed man, and for the worse. He had a wife and 2 children. And first, the wife disappeared, and her name is Wanda Medeiros Rainey. And that was mysterious. He told police she got on a bus going over to Wareham to be with family. Never seen again. She's presumed dead. For years, the police tried to track down clues. They dug up foundations. He would even toy with them. He'd say, you pass her every day. That mystery is buried with him. No one knows where she is. A year later, a teenager was found killed in a bog across from Melvin Rainey's house, last seen with, at the time, Shirley Souza, who was a babysitter for the Rainey family. And she would go on to be Melvin's second wife. But he was shot dead, they say execution style. Again, never solved. Melvin Rainey always has been suspected in that because he was one of the last people to see Charles Jeff Flanagan alive. And I spoke to Mr. Flanagan, Jeff's father, this week, who, he said good riddance to Melvin Rainey. He's still upset after all these years that no justice for his son. And really, he believes in his heart that it was Melvin Rainey, but he always wanted to see some justice brought. And it goes on. Another person, Paul Allwart, 17-year-old, he was in the Department of Youth Services, but he befriended Melvin Rainey, 17 years old, worked for him, and did some arsons with him, apparently, according to investigators. And he was scheduled to testify against Melvin Rainey in 1978. And a Falmouth police officer put him on a ferry over to Martha's Vineyard, where he had family, and to protect him, never heard from again. And he is presumed dead, and his body has never been recovered. And then 1979, a Falmouth police officer was shot. He survived. He was shot in the face on his way to work. His name's John Busby. And he believes it was Melvin Rainey who did it. He had run-ins with Melvin Rainey. A few weeks before the shooting, he had stopped one of Melvin's sons. There was a confrontation. He actually had to chase the son in a car. The son went to the family house. There was a confrontation there between Melvin Rainey and the police officer, threats made, and then a few weeks later, this officer is shot. Complicating matters is alleged police corruption, that Falmouth police officers actually helped Melvin Rainey in this assassination attempt of this police officer, that they gave him the route of John Busby. They told him, when he showed up for work, they told him that he wouldn't have a gun because he had small children at home and he didn't bring his gun home with him, so he wouldn't be armed at the time. And just a horrible story there, because Busby was shot in the face, as I said. He's gone through years of surgery. He and his family went into hiding, thinking that Melvin Rainey would someday come back and finish the job. And, they were just really terrified by that fact and, by the fact that some of their own had turned against them. And so it's just a long story. It's he was a complicated man, because at the same time, you'll hear from people, the guy was a hard worker. He owned a trash hauling company in Falmouth. And people say he was up in early in the morning. He always made his rounds. He did his job. People say if he worked as hard at being a good person, mm-hmm. It would be amazing what he could have accomplished. Now, in 2001, he was facing some other charges and was in a courtroom. And he did some weird stuff in the courtroom. He asked the judge, for example, the benches are hard in the courtroom, and he said, "You need some cushions for these." And he got up from his seat and he approached the judge, and the judge ended up sending him for evaluation. And that's how he wound up in Taunton State Hospital. He never got out again. He was diagnosed there with Pick's disease. That was he went in 2001. The diagnosis came sometime after, and he never got out again.
It's a dementia disease?
It's a dementia disease. It affects the frontal lobe. you're only supposed to be able to survive like 3 to 4 years. And he was, we're talking 12 years that he was in. So maybe initially it was a misdiagnosis or something. But in any event, he died over the weekend. While he was in there, his second wife was killed. That's Shirley Rainey.
Right.
There is a man, John Rams, who's facing charges in that case. But that's what dredged all this up again for people, was when she was killed in 2005. People started looking at it and saying, you know, who did this to her? Was it payback for some of the things that Melvin was accused of over the years? And just a really fascinating is a word I would use. Family history there. For the families, just it's so painful because I talked to Busby this week. As I said, I talked to Mr. Flanagan this week, and the same theme kept coming up, and that is secrets that are buried with him, you know, answers he's taken to the grave that they'll never get.
Terrible. Let's move on to another story in Falmouth concerning the land-based wind turbines here. There are two land-based wind turbines, well, actually a third, but the two are owned by the town of Falmouth, and some folks who live near those turbines have complained about health effects and sleep issues because of the turbines. It's been an ongoing story, and now it's been in the courts as the town has been, I don't know, suing itself, I guess we could say.
Yeah, and there was a development in the courtroom where there was a supposed agreement reached between the town and these people to reduce the number of hours of operation from 16 hours down to 12. And, you know, we wrote about it, others wrote about it and talked about it. And then at town meeting this week, sort of a bombshell was dropped where one of the selectmen said, it's a little premature. There is talk of an agreement, but it hasn't been voted on by selectmen yet. And they're going to be meeting, I think, coming up this week on Monday in executive session. So
the town attorney, the attorney who's representing the town, says in front of a judge, myself and the other attorney, we've come to an agreement. Here's what it is. The judge says, okay. And then you guys report it. We report it. Everyone thinks that's the case. And then in town meeting, the selectmen say, no, that's not the case at all.
That's right. It has people scratching their heads. You know, Sean Driscoll, who's the reporter on this, said the town turbines are generating more confusion than clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a pretty good way to put it. Nobody knows exactly what the answer is here, whether that agreement that was reached in court before a judge, the attorney for the people who are bringing this complaint said he doesn't believe that the town is violating any court order here, that it still does have to be codified in some way. But it really is a strange turn of events. And in an ongoing saga here, where it ends, you know, often with court things, it does take a while to get things settled.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what's going on, and people have their own suspicions about what's going on and what motivates different people in this debate. But one thing you cannot deny is that what has happened in Falmouth has affected the debate around the state about the installation of wind turbines, and it seems like now the state is taking some action maybe when it comes to siting turbines.
Yeah, so we have a story in today's paper that they're seeking comments, public comments from people on wind turbine siting. And, you know, if people do have strong opinions about this, they ought to look at the website today or look at the paper today where we have information on how you can get your comments heard. Interestingly, Patrick Cassidy, who follows the wind debate for us quite a bit, writes that not a lot of people knew that there was this opportunity. It hadn't been widely advertised. So for folks who this is important to, whether it's land-based or offshore wind, they might want to take note of this and have their opinions heard.
Right. Let's move on and talk about medical marijuana and dispensaries. That process, the opening of dispensaries, is happening around the state. A few communities here on the Cape have taken the lead, while some communities have decided, you know what, we're going to put this off for a year-long moratorium. Other communities have said, no, let's just address it and find a place to put these if the bidders actually get a license and are allowed to move forward. So we've heard about Dennis quite a bit, and we can talk about Dennis, but Bourne entered the discussion this week.
That's right. Well, Bourne had one of those moratoriums on its town meeting warrant, and they voted against it. They said, no, maybe we're open to this. And that started the ball rolling fairly quickly on a proposal in that town at the Cartwheels 2 facility on MacArthur Boulevard.
There's got to be some irony opening it in a child play center, right?
Well, the town planner even says, you know, when she was thinking of where could we say it's okay to have these in town, she was saying, well, MacArthur Boulevard's a good spot, but we would have to be somewhere away from Cartwheels. And so what we have here is a situation where they're looking at putting this at that location. The application has gone in, and we'll see where that goes. MacArthur Boulevard could be a possible location because there is other industry over there. It's interesting. She said she didn't know of any other place in that area that might have some opposition to this, and we certainly haven't heard any yet, but this is a really new development. Mm-hmm. So give the public some time, you know, to weigh in on this.
And so what's happening in Dennis? Now we hear about even more folks who are interested in finding a spot in the town of Dennis.
Right. There's two of them in Dennis that are competing for the same location, apparently. And again, one of the groups is the same one that's looking in Bourne. So it's interesting that this has become sort of the new industry here, and that there is so much interest here on Cape Cod. I guess there are going to be like 35 of these potentially across the state. And it's really heated up here on the Cape with these two proposals in Dennis, the one in Bourne, there may be others as well as this shakes out.
Okay, we'll be following that story. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, is going to join us on the phone, talk about some happenings in Chatham.
Summer visitor Paddy O'Sullivan from Ireland with his squeeze box.
First time I got a squeeze box was my father arrived home with a one-row, single button, we call it, the button accordion. He was a policeman in Ireland. He was a detective sergeant in Fitzgibbon Street Garda Station. And somebody had taught him how to play South of the Border on it. And he showed me how to play South of the Border. I'm not a perfectionist. I'm not a great box player either in Irish terms. But I enjoy it. And it's good for the soul. And it's good to relax. And I'm happy with that.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
I'm Marco Werman. Pac-Man and Peso are a young hip-hop duo from Washington, D.C. This weekend, they'll board a plane for the first time. A hip-hop promoter got them the tickets and the visas. Destination, North Korea.
I was like, damn, I want to go to North Korea. You know what I'm saying? They're serious. Like, dang, like, yeah, we're going to shoot a video in North Korea.
Two rappers create some buzz the Dennis Rodman way. That's next time on The World.
Join us for The World tonight at 8 on WCAI.
Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan, a senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Tim, let's talk about what's happening in West Chatham when it comes to the roadway there. Very local issue, but important if you're trying to get around that area.
Sure. This stretch of Route 28 we're talking about is in the main business district in West Chatham. And it's been pretty controversial for several years now. An initial plan included a roundabout and traffic light and the elimination of a center turning lane along this 1,200-foot stretch of roadway. That plan was so unpopular that every business owner in the area was against it. More than 2,000 people signed a petition opposed to it, and when the selectmen persisted in their support of it, a group of opponents took it to town meeting, where a majority of people rejected the use of federal and state funds to do this, to pay for these improvements, but the selectmen ignored them, told their engineers to go ahead with new plans, the best possible plans for this area. They came up with those plans this past Tuesday, and they basically called for two small roundabouts to bookend the area, one at George Ryder Road, one at Barnhill Road, elimination of the center turning lane, construction of a bike lane, and a multimodal path along the street. The engineers basically said that the traffic volume in this area, as well as traffic speeds, even during the peak summer periods, were not as severe as or as high as people had thought. Business owners had been worried that if you take out the center turning lane, people would simply bypass the area. They wouldn't wait in traffic to try to take that left-hand turn. But the engineers said that that's not likely to happen, that any delays from people, vehicles trying to turn, will be very small, very short, because traffic really isn't as heavy as people suspect. Selectmen like the plan. There wasn't much feedback at the meeting Tuesday, but we've since heard from some business owners that they still don't like the loss of the center turning lane there. Selectmen have basically instructed the engineers to go out and meet with those business owners. There's going to be a 28-day comment period that will end December 10th. And then another meeting will be held on December 17th for further discussions of this plan.
Any goals of when to actually start construction?
Well, it's on the Transportation Improvement Plan, I believe, for 2016, I think, or 14 maybe. $3.7 million or $3.4 million in federal and state funding are targeted towards this. But it's kind of similar to the situation in Harwich with the improvement of Route 124. People are saying, well, you know, we don't feel it's really broke. Why are we taking this federal and state money to fix something that we're not worried about?
I see. Let's talk about another plan, this one, a management plan for the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. There was a deadline for that from the Fish and Wildlife Service. What happened?
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Service missed the deadline. The deadline was for the first week in November to release a draft of a 15-year comprehensive management plan, comprehensive conservation management plan, they call it. The Fish and Wildlife officials say that partially responsible for the missing the deadline was the government shutdown from last month, but they also say that this plan is so complex that it's taking a lot longer for their internal review. And one of the reasons Chatham is sort of on tenterhooks waiting for this plan is that it's sort of been in the works for 10 years.
What's the goal? What are they trying to do?
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Service is mandated to come up with a plan like this for every single one of their refuges. And the refuge complex that Monomoy is part of has completed all their other plans except the Monomoy one. The main issue here in Chatham is that 10 years ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service, when they started this process, said, you know, part of Monomoy is a congressionally designated wilderness area, and they found out through going through the documents that in a wilderness area, all commercial activity is prohibited. They interpreted that to include commercial shellfishing. And at the time, Monomoy was the commercial shellfishing area off of Chatham. It was responsible for millions of dollars worth of shellfish being harvested every year. That resource has sort of diminished over the years, but it's still important to Chatham to protect the rights of local residents to commercially shellfish in that area. The plan will have details about this. Fish and Wildlife has been mum about what the plan is going to say about commercial shellfishing. There's been a sort of task agreement in the last decade while the town sort of got their ducks in a row to combat this designation, this possible prohibition. The Fish and Wildlife have allowed commercial shellfishing to continue, But there's a lot of trepidation on the part of Chatham officials and Shell fishermen about what's going to happen in the future. So this draft plan is very critical. The Fish and Wildlife people say before they release it publicly, they're going to set up a meeting with town officials to give them a heads up as to what's in the plan. No date has been set for that. Fish and Wildlife officials are now saying that the plan is more likely to be ready to release in either late December or January. Basically, town officials and residents here are saying, well, we'll believe that when we see it. We've been told this for, you know, almost a decade. So.
Okay. Well, you can continue to follow that one there, Tim.
Indeed. Indeed.
Tim, sorry I'm coughing under some of your report there. I'm battling a cold, but I appreciate it. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Sean. Take care.
Yeah, I'll try. George Brennan is with me here in the Woods Hole studio from the Cape Cod Times. George, there was a story. It's on the inside of one of the Thursday paper, but it caught my eye, this guilty plea in a case of a gentleman who is accused, or I guess has been sentenced for some fraudulent activities surrounding the inspections of school buses.
Right. He pleaded guilty. His name's Richard Sylvia. He pleaded guilty to 41 counts of insufficient vehicle inspections while he owned a company called Bristol County Tire Service. And why that's important here is because he had the contract to inspect first student buses used by both Denison Yarmouth and the Nauset Regional Schools. So there were buses here on Cape Cod that had been inspected by this gentleman's company. We're told that none of the children or the bus drivers were ever in any danger because once this was found out, further inspections were done on the buses. But there must have been a gap in between, I would imagine, where they didn't know that this was going on. So it's pretty scary, you know, if you're a parent out there, you put a lot of faith in the fact that you're putting your kid on a safe school bus every morning, and someone was out there just rubber stamping, so to speak, these inspections and not doing them properly.
Right. It's not just emissions that you're worried about, but they test the brakes on those buses.
Right. Right. There's so many components to it, and it's one of those cases where when it came up a few years ago. When the indictments first came down, it was a head scratcher, and now he's pleaded guilty to it. It's just one of those things. What is someone thinking? How could you live with yourself if one of these buses were to go out of control and injure a bunch of fourth and fifth graders or first graders?
Sure.
Or something like that?
What's the penalty that he's facing here?
Let's see. He pleaded guilty, and there were 41 counts. So. Sorry, I'm not.
No, that's okay. I know he's going away. Yeah. They're sending him to prison for it. Yeah. And I was just curious how long, and I'm glad they're sending him to, send a message with this one. We can take a look at that and get back to it. Let's move on. Let's move on to this next story here about the lack of applicants for Habitat Humanity houses in Centerville.
Yeah, this one's another head scratcher because. It's not for a lack of need. There's certainly plenty of need out there for people, especially here on the Cape, for affordable housing. But in this case, there were only 11 families who put in applications for this new house, which is now under construction on Ginger Lane in Centerville. Normally, what Habitat officials told us is that they would expect at least 20 families to put in applications for this. And that's among, hundreds of people who usually show some interest. We're told what happens is, people go to these meetings and look into Habitat for Humanity houses. And some drop out because they just don't think they're going to meet the eligibility requirements. They look at their credit history and some of those things and, don't believe that they're going to get through and don't want to take the risk, so to speak. And then other people are concerned with the sweat equity that you have to put in, although you get family and friends to help you as well. It's not just the homeowner who has to put in sweat equity. They can and certainly plenty of people are willing to help out. So the takeaway from this story is Habitat for Humanity people saying, listen, stick with the process. don't worry about, you know, whether you qualify or not. Go put in the application. Let them tell you you don't qualify, but at least put through the application and stay with the process. And don't worry about the work that you have to put into this, that there are ways to get others to help you. But again, you know, this is there's plenty of need here on the Cape for affordable housing.
Right. Well, you don't want to see a trend. There are 9 other houses in the pipeline right now in Falmouth, Mashpee, Centerville, Orleans. They've got 19 more planned, I understand.
Yep. Yep.
But one interesting thing that in the story, one of the interesting things was 240 families applied for affordable rental housing on Stagecoach Road. So rental housing is certainly attracting a lot of attention.
And this might be one of those things where, you know, people are fear the ownership of something versus, you know, rental. You can get in and out if you have to, but ownership, you know, it's a little bit more of a commitment, so to speak, and that might be what's driving that.
We started the show off today talking about developments over on Martha's Vineyard with the tribe there saying that they have some federal permissions here to move forward with an island casino. And joining us on the phone now is Nelson. Nelson, tell us I'm interested in the reaction around the island to this news.
Well, I think it's fairly safe to say that it's not being embraced. If you think about it, for people who've been to Martha's Vineyard, it's not really the type of place people move to or visit because they want to be able to spend time at a slot parlor. And generally speaking, what I've been hearing is that people are adamantly opposed to it, including many of the members of the Wampanoag tribe who live in Aquinnah. That's their hometown. It's a very small town. Again, anyone that's ever visited, it's really just a few main roads. In the off-season, it's awfully quiet. In the summer, the seasonal people that have lived there, many of them for a long time, they enjoy going to the beach, doing things with their family.
Right,
so
sure.
It would change the nature of the town.
Nelson, is the thought that this is a really an earnest bid to open up something on the island, or is this really your analysis? Is this really a way to get the governor to the table to negotiate?
Well, you know, people that have been watching the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead try to enter the casino scrum, if you will, for a long time think this is really just an effort to try and exert some leverage on the governor so that they can pursue something on the mainland. Because realistically, again, a casino, or you call it what you want, a Class 2 gaming facility in Aquinnah is not going to be any sort of a major moneymaker. I mean, the community center is small. So this looks like an effort to do that. I had one tribal member say it's nothing more than an election ploy, because on Sunday the tribe goes to the polls to elect chairman, and the current chairman, Cheryl Andrews Maltes, is being challenged by Tobias Vanderhoop. So there's that in play as well. But, you know, it's hard to figure the strategy here, but it seems to me to be another in a many efforts to gain some kind of leverage in terms of the whole gaming argument.
Nelson, this is George Brennan. Isn't distance an issue too? It's at least a 40-minute ride from the ferries to Aquinnah.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, you can look at this in a lot of different ways, I suppose, and try and analyze it as a strict business venture. And if you do that, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, given, you know, let's face it, you're not going to have Cirque du Soleil performing up at Gay Head. So, you know, what kind of a facility would you end up with, really? What, 100, 200 slot machines in a big hall? It just doesn't make any practical sense. And I'm not a business person in terms of how casinos work, but in the story this week, a fellow that studies this sort of thing chimed in and said it just doesn't make any sense. But at the heart of all this is the settlement agreement the tribe signed in 1983, and that was approved by the legislature, and it went to the Congress, and it said that they would be subject to all federal, state, and local laws, including zoning laws. So it seems like the tribe's got a way to go here. I know that on Tuesday they were waiving that that legal opinion, but as Clyde Barrow, a professor for UMass Dartmouth, and he's the director of the Center for Public Policy Analysis, he said it's just a legal opinion from a staff attorney, and it's not a judicial opinion. So I think that's an important issue as well.
Okay, Nelson Siegelman is from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We appreciate you calling in, Nelson. Did you get a deer today?
You're giving away all my secrets. I did not.
Oh, I'm sorry to embarrass you here on public radio. Thanks, Nelson. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week.
Good enough.
Okay. And George Brennan is with me in the studio. George, you don't have much time left here, but I want to quickly talk about this story that was in the paper on Sunday about a different attempt on the life of President John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, this was fascinating to me. I saw a little item that there was going to be this documentary coming up on another assassination attempt against JFK, and I said, I never heard about that. I asked lots of people, have you ever heard of this? And many of them said no, and so I decided to look into it, and what I found was that when he was the president-elect and he was down in Palm Beach putting together his cabinet, there was a real attempt against him. It was a New Hampshire man. He was anti-Catholic. He didn't like Kennedy. He thought the Kennedy family had purchased the presidency. And so he followed him around the country, and he bought sticks of dynamite at a New Hampshire hardware store, carried those in the trunk of his Buick, left New Hampshire, followed the president around, and he was going to make this attempt on his life.
People can go and read that story at Cape Cod Online, and then on Sunday you have a story, or there's a story coming up in the Sunday paper about a mother who went down to Guantanamo Bay to watch some trials down there.
That's Patricia DeCanto. She's the mother of Jerry DeCanto, who was killed in the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001.
Okay, we can look forward to that story on Sunday. Thanks, George Brennan, senior reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Great thanks to Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, and then we heard from Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times calling in. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.